Welcome to another riveting episode of Hallowed Waters Podcast. I am your host, Matthew Sapinski, and we are here in part two of the Catskill Trout Fishing Legacy. Hope you all enjoyed part one. We dived into the legends and the lore for all you trotafario trout bum troubadours, all you hatch-matching bug craze Catskill code cracking crusaders. We do this for you and for our passion and love for the sport and the waters that we love. We are probably going to be going to part three and part four because we have so much material to cover, and I am somehow in this Italian mode lately. I've been writing blogs on in search of pasta and the ecstasy and agony of pasta. So if I use a lot of benvenuti, which means welcome in Italian, as we all know, then we're just having fun because we are two signores trying to figure out the trotafario. And trotafario is brown trout, legacy of the Catskills. And that's where we are going today. Our series is a three, probably going to end up four-part series of the Catskill trout fishing dynasty, the legends, the lore, the rivers, the hatches, the tactics, the presentation, the past, future, and present, and where we go with all this. And today we are going to dive in with my illustrious guest that I introduced in the last first part one, so I'm not going to reintroduce him, but he is the wonderful New York City gallivanting angler, connoisseur, Schwiebert-esque personality that has taken a total passion for his love of fly fishing around the world, and especially his waters of the Catskills, where all the New York City gentlemen go. And we're going to be diving in today to the rivers, to the hatches, and then into part three and part four, the tactics and the presentation. So there is a lot of meaty stuff we need to get to. But first of all, I'd like to say it was a crazy week here this week. We've had one ice storm upon another ice storm upon another power outage upon another power outage. Then we had a backup with ice in our in our well, and then it's been just crazy. And last night we had more ice, and so there's a lot going on. And the people in California, prayers and blessings out to you for the stuff that you've been enduring. 15 feet of snow, houses buried. Yeah, it's even close to Los Angeles. I mean, it's just the weather's going nuts. But we're going to be here to make sure that you have something to listen to. And people say, what are you guys doing? Are you guys trying to grandstand, show off your knowledge or what you're trying to do? No, what we're trying to do is bring back the arts of the literature and the arts of the passion and the tactics and the diving into the science and the bugs and the rivers and what the foundation of American fly fishing was. And somehow we've forgotten about that. We've now tended to become a social media oriented fly fishing sport where everything is glitz and glamour and promotion and self-promotion and more promotion. And it's just like, it's a bombardment I don't know if it's dissonance. It's sort of like dissonance, because sometimes we feel fear, or we fear the fact that there is so much we don't know. And what us two old white dudes are trying to do with my guest today is to try to bring back some of this knowledge. And it's all revolves around the many wonderful books that have been written about this, which we are going to talk about today. And, you know, if you look at this podcast of anything, it is sort of books on tape. So people's lives today are very complicated. I don't want to sit there with a 200-300-page book and get into this and that. So if you could just plug us in on your car, on your Apple Play, and listen to what we're saying while you're driving to your destinations or back and forth, that's sort of what we are. Think of us as books on tape. And, you know, our podcast is not going to have all the solutions. Our podcast is not going to have all the answers. There's so much out there that we could probably spend another 20 hours with, to be honest with you. But we're going to touch on today the rivers, get into their lore. We're going to get into the hatches, the super hatches. That's a whole 3-4 episodes in itself, but we're going to try to make this. If you're coming to the Catskills, if you love the Catskills, if you fish the Catskills all your life, we're going to try to bring you this information that sometimes you just don't think about. And sometimes it takes other fly fishermen to talk about them. And that's what our lore was about in part one. We were talking about Gordon and Hewitt and Reed and Jennings and Emmett Gill and Norris and all the guys that, you know, sort of pieced this together. And our guest today, of course, and which will be the guest for the rest of the series, is Joe Ceballos. He is our gallivanting New York City angler, historian, president of the Catskill Fly Tires Guild. And on that note, Joe, we welcome you back. And it is so good to have you back for part two. How are you doing today, Joe?
Doing very well. Thank you very much. Enjoying our mild weather, so to speak, but doing quite well.
Wonderful, wonderful. Joe, you know, we're going to get into mayflies. We're going to get into caddis flies. We're going to get into stoneflies. One thing that, you know, Joe and I talked about earlier was, you know, there's so much changes going on in the nomenclature and taxonomy of mayflies and stoneflies and caddisflies and all bugs in general. And it's all emanating out of, you know, certain foundations of the bug entomology, like Purdue University, which is like sort of the, you know, the hallowed waters of the bugdom. And they have and they change names from Stenonema to Macrophytium and all these, Macaphritium and all these other names that are just bopping around and doing things and back and forth. Hydropsyche to Cerritopsyches and this kind of psyche. And so there is a website called Mayfly Central. It's sort of like an online clearinghouse for old mayfly names and stonefly names and caddisfly and midge names and blah, blah, blah. So if you ever, it's by a guy from Jacobs from IUPUI, Indiana University, Purdue in Columbus. So if you want to look at modern names of these bugs, you could go there. But I think what Joe and I have discussed is we're going to stick with the names that Swisher Richards, Cauchy Nastasi, Arbona, La Fontaine, the guys that sort of wrote the premier volumes, the masterpieces on the insect hatches. We're going to stick with the names that they've used for clarity, also for common, you know, ground. So I'm not saying potatoes, you're saying potatoes, Joe's not saying tomatoes and tomatoes. So on that note, that's where we're going to be. We've gotten tons of questions. I've gotten dozens of emails and questions, and we're going to save all the questions for the last episode that we're going to do either part three or part four. So we're going to hold on to those questions until we get a lot of grip going on. But speaking of new books, my good friend and fanatical fly fisher, Charles Cutter, came out with a murder mystery called Under the Ashes. So I told him I'd give him a great plug. It's a great book on wild mushroom hunting, and somebody ate a mushroom. Was he killed by the mushroom, or was he killed by the murderer? We don't know. So go to Amazon and buy Under the Ashes. So on that note, we are going to jump right in, Joe. And I think you had a couple things you wanted to talk about, Gordon, from the last one. And we're trying to bring reality to these figures, because today we think of them as gods, and we think of them as somebody that these people did. So, you know, if you look at the fly fishing world today, nothing has changed. It's the same as the past, and the past is going to be the same as the future. It's a passion of a hobby. We're hobbyists. We're eternal hobbyists. We love something, and now we're making money off it, and we're making our lives and careers off it. And but in essence, all the things that are involved with human beings of jealousies and insecurities and fears, and I want to be the best, and he's the best, and Gordon was the best, and Christian was the best, and Hewitt was the best, and all the things that happened in the past, and who ties a better fly? I tie a better. Oh, he doesn't know what he's doing. It's the same stuff. We're all sort of platforming for our own, you know, personification, because, you know, we are not going to cure cancer with this stuff. We're not going to fly to another dimension and galaxy, even though this Hollowed Water podcast does go to other galaxies to find talent and other trout streams and salmon rivers that aren't overrun by a bunch of crazy sheep with fly rods. Anyways, so Joe, I'm going to go back to you right away, and a couple of things that you wanted to know, because of things that in general about the personalities and the persona of these Catskill people in the past. You had a couple thoughts, Joe. Go ahead.
One of the things I wanted to mention about Gordon, and dovetails basically into what you said. Gordon was very fascinated by all sorts of things that he could use for fly tying. And as example of this, and it's explained in McDonald's book, he would go into a general store and he would look at, for example, go over and look at material. In those days, you know, general store, they had everything. You know, different materials, fabric and lace and things of that. And he would look and say, yeah, is this applicable? Can I use this? So he really had an open mind, which is quite interesting. Furthermore, he, in later years, as we know, he was quite ill. He had tuberculosis. So he became kind of recluse. And something about him that maybe a lot of people might not know is that he was starving for attention, and he was looking for attention. And in fact, if he wrote to Halford, he would agree with Halford. And anything Halford said, oh, yes, I totally agree, I agree. And then he would write to Skews, and Skews would write back, oh, yeah, that's the best ride. He would kind of agree with all these individuals to kind of get their favor in a way. And that's just something to go to the human side, and also about his passion. Another note that I would throw in there to dovetail again back to what you said about websites, there's a website called Trout Nut, one word. And I think it's Jason Neuberger. He does an excellent job. If people are interested in scientific names as well as the common names for trout, and he has absolutely phenomenal photos of all the, you know, different mayflies that you want to look at. He does absolutely fantastic work, and he deserves some recognition. And last point would be and also to go a little bit backwards in terms of our history. There are three books that I think are quite important and we'll work on. We will mention information from those books today. And two of them will be Austin Francis books, Catskill Rivers and Land of Little Rivers. And the last one would be Ed Van Putt's Trout Fishing in the Catskills. Those three books give a tremendous amount of history and background, how the Catskills developed, how the fisheries evolved, and basically little histories of the famous fly tires. So I highly recommend those three books to get a firm knowledge of the Catskill history. So in that respect, that's all I would have to, you know, from the last podcast. So we can move forward with today's agenda.
Wonderful. Yeah. Those books are like the foundations of the Catskills. And we're going to talk a little bit about those books today, but we're going to dive in right now into the Catskill Rivers. And, you know, the Land of Little Rivers, like Mac Francis says, what's really unique about these rivers is the situation of the way the elevation, the way they're surrounded by almost like the driftless area, and like they're little coulees and little valleys and little tributaries and little trickles and rivulets and spates of water that just collects in an ideal pocket. And if you look at the ideal pocket, which is always a battleground from weather systems coming out of the west, weather systems coming out of the south, weather systems coming off the coast, and these rivers are this little, I don't even know how, it's like a hollowed circle of water. And the water just accumulates and percolates and trickles over time. And the setup from going from high gradient, tiny brooks, Appalachian brooks in the headwaters of the Neversink, the Beaverkill, the Willowemic, all these rivers, the East Branch, West Branch. And then you dive into midsections of water that look like gentle valley freestoners surrounded by mountains. And then you have tailwaters, which are giant spring creeks. And you're basically dealing with this headwater, middle gradient, pool pocket, long, flat, lower section eddies. You have absolutely every style of river system in each of these river systems that we're going to talk about. And what they're beautifully made for is for all three species that we have in the Catskills have their own niche habitats. And I think those niche habitats, you know, today we say, oh God, you know, the brown trout is an exotic invader and the rainbow trout is an exotic invader and everything should be broken. I think the beauty of these rivers is they have the ability to harbor all three species. You have brook trout in the higher up Appalachian style mountain brooks that are, you know, the sedimentary rock that are these big, huge boulders that are in all the Catskill rivers. And then you have the lower, flat, slower sections, the long eddies and pools at the brown trout light. And then you have some rapids and rainbow water that you have on certain rivers like the Esopus and the Big Delaware. And so there's a place for everything here. But I think we talk about the brown trout a lot is because it was the marquee fish of New York State. It was when we brought the brown trout here, which we talked about in the last episode, New York really made it their hero fish that saved trout fishing in America as we know it. And as development happens, development allows for more marginal temperatures, waters to warm up in the summer, the seesaw of flows from climate change. The ultimate survivor is brown trout and even rainbow trout in a lot of these rivers because they could tolerate more. But this habitat is still there for the brook wild and native indigenous brook trout of the Appalachians. And I think that is the true essence and beauty of the Catskills is that you have all of this. And climate change is going to be a game changer. When I had Dr. Bachman on my podcast several podcasts ago, he said climate change is ravaging Pennsylvania right now. He said it's changing the whole game. The hatches, one article that I think, Joe, you pointed out to me, I think was in Washington Post, saying that mayflies are on part of the sixth mass extinction that the Earth is experiencing right now, things of that nature. So these issues are going to be part of it. But Browns have adapted to the pressure. They learned to night feeding pools. They learned to tolerate these fluctuations in flows. But you still have these headwaters of pure brook trout water. So if you want to encompass all of this, you have it there. And Joe, I'm going to toss that back to you on your whole personal feeling of how these rivers mesh together and their importance.
Sure, Matt. One thing that you pointed out is if you look at, for example, the Beaverkill, the Willowemuck, and you look at the greater drainage of the river system, all these brooks, small streams that feed into these both rivers, they help as well. And where they're situated, where the Beaverkill starts, basically way up near the Balsam Lake area, you have an elevation of 3,000 feet. And that area up there, you know, the canopy is quite good. The small streams have still canopy. So the upper section of the river for a long ways will still maintain some of its cooler temperatures. But of course, as the stream flows further down, for example, from that basic source to Roscoe, it's about 27 miles. And what has happened as a result from what we talked about previously about fishing and overfishing, that section, given its topography and location, a lot of private clubs establish themselves up there and kind of preserves that fishery. So even in some lower water situations, you'd still have some decent fishing. But once you get down to Roscoe and you flow from Roscoe down to where what we call the Jaws, where it meets the East Branch, it's about another 15 and a half miles. And that's the section of the river that we're most known to be fishing at because it's public water and you have a tremendous amount of public water in that area. So, and of course, that would also apply. Think about the Willowemuck, which is another stream that what flows in. It's the Willow actually is quite long, believe it or not. And it's a little bit longer than the Beaverkill. It's like 40 something miles. And again, you know, the upper reaches, again, has that elevation issue, like 2,000 feet, 2,500 feet, and you have all the small brooks that come in. And it's you know, dotted with private clubs and such. But further down, not a little further down from these private areas, before it reaches the Junction Pool, there's still a fair amount of public water. And it's quite interesting. So, of course, when that comes into the Junction Pool, now you have some really decent flows for that 15 miles down to where it meets the East Branch. And, of course, the Freestone, and it's affected by temperature and weather. And, unfortunately, as you mentioned, with, you know, climate change can be affecting the fishing. However, it is noted that back in history, we've had over 100 years ago, we've had droughts. We've had hot weather. As a note, in 1913, the Beaverkill registered the main stem, which would be the Little Beaverkill, which is the upper section, and the Willow, where from there was 13 CFS.
Wow.
That's fairly low. Now, this past season, it was quite low as well. It was like 30 in the 30s or 40 CFS. So what we're experiencing now is a reflection of what we've had in the past, although we're probably having more of the past bad weather more prevalent than we are today. And what's another throwback to Theodore Gordon was his comment about, well, we used to catch 6-inch fish, meaning the brookies, and you'd be lucky to catch one 14 inches. And what was it, 1902, he remarks, I caught a brown trout and it was like 17 inches. And he says, that's pretty interesting. And he goes, it's not uncommon to catch fish up to 20 inches. So he was really enthusiastic about the brown trout. And as we mentioned, the brown trout really changed the fishing and fishing techniques for these two rivers. So,
yeah, absolutely. You know, I think when you Cecil Hiox wrote a beautiful book, The Complete Brown Trout, which I talked a lot about in my Brown Trout Nexus book. And, you know, he was at Cornell and he embodied the belief, you know, he said, quote, to the dry fly fisherman, the brown trout is the wariest, wiliest, most fascinating, challenging, respected, and best loved trout of all. I'm sure a lot of people that like brook trout and rainbow trout will disagree with that. And I love them all and you love them all. And a trout is a trout. But I think the fact that the Catskills were that ground zero when they introduced the brown trout in Aiden Brook on the Never Sink, and it was that poster child of the New York DEC or the, you know, whatever it was called back then, that they wanted it to work. But what's really interesting about the Catskill streams is that it's sort of like the holy grail of brown trout Truda territory. And I wrote in my Nexus book, the study, quote that sort of embodies it. The study of riverine substrate is a biotic function of how water and time, hydrology, and how the almighty's chisel of the ecosystem, creations, glaciers, floods, geological events, etched out prime Salmo Truda habitat that is the magnet for them. They are extremely fond of gravel, mid-sized rocks, and large boulders that give them advantages both from bioenergetics, conservation standpoint, shelter, ambush, feeding advantages, and their ability to shield light for those photophobic creatures that love dark places. This strong attraction to these rocky places were revealed to me at a young age by coincidental encounters. So what I'm trying to say, basically, if you look at the biotic structure of these rivers, boulders, rock, gravel, boulders, deep pools, all the places that brown trout love to be in, and they love to hide in places like that. And in those crevices and rocks are the aquatic insects, the mayflies, the stoneflies, the caddisflies, sculpins. It's a perfect environment for them, and it's a perfect environment for trout, period. And the fact that the rivers are constant twisting and bending, snake-like rivers with all the channels and tributaries coming in, and accumulation of water and the geology of the structure just makes them like perfect trout streams. And, you know, you look at like the old Milwaukee Bush commercials and Milwaukee Light and the commercials, there's two guys with flannel shirts with creel standing in the trout stream. And it always looked like it was in the Catskills. And the Catskills embody a trout stream. You just think of it, a trout stream, when you see these rivers. And, you know, what's your thoughts of the this rock structure, Joe?
Well, the rock structure, you can't argue with, certainly helps the streams. In other words, it aerates the water. It provides holding for fish on, you know, one side or another of a rock. You have a bucket at times, you know, below a rock, but holding water. You have, you know, for example, the beaver kill, you have, you know, boulders, rocks, whatever, and pools, and you'll have that sort of calm water behind that rock, and you perfect holding water for fish. So you can't argue with it. And for example, the public sections of the Never Sink also offer very similar conditions, you know, as another river that of historical significance. You know, the length of the river, of course, the elevation, and the Never Sink is a little bit different. The grade is just slightly less than the Willow and the Beaverkill. And you have a lot on the upper sections of the Never Sink. You have long, flat pools. And then the lower section, you'll have more, freestone water. But definitely, that helps to improve trout habitat. But, you know, slow moving water, you know, fish don't like it. They like a little bit faster water, you know, browns. They'll feed in slower pools, you know, and then you got holding lines and, you know, and feeding lanes and such, and they'll move around. But your rocks, and you see rocks, you know, and that trickle of foam coming off those rocks, what do we say? Foam is home. So yeah. I totally agree.
Absolutely. You know, I think what we're seeing with climate change is the fact that we're seeing less severe winters in the mid-Atlantic and the East Coast. And in the old days, if you look back at some of the ice jams on the Beaver Kill, you know, you look back at some of the photos from the early 1900s and, you know, 1930s and 20s and teens, you had these monsters, ice jams, the 30, 40 foot high ice jams, people walking over the Beaver Kill in Delaware. You know, you don't have them as much. Now we're having these mild winters, another mild day, another mild winter. And I think that bodes favorably for wild trout to a certain degree, because a lot of fish were lost with these ice jams. This anchor ice was always notorious in the Catskills. And every year was how good was the fishing was based on how many fish survived the winter from the anchor ice and the lockups. And we're not having those severe winters as much as more. Yeah, we're having severe weather, but to have like a 4-3 months of just 10, 15, 20 below zero every night, if we get one or two of those days now a year, it's a miracle to go below zero. I don't think we even went below zero here in Michigan all winter this year. So wild trout will definitely be favored by not having this winter ice up. But how long will the water last? And I think when it comes down to the Catskills in the long haul, it's going to be the battle for water, as it has been with the tailwaters and what Futter is trying to do, and you know, the New York City Water Authority and the tailwaters. And so that battle is going to come down, and how long that water is going to last is going to be, you know, the big issue. But I think if you really look at what the Catskills has more than anything is the ice cold tailwaters. And that has transformed the fishery to the point now where it seems like everybody's fishing the West Branch and the East Branch and you know, the Neversink and tailwaters. And so we're going to start, you know, that's a thought. What are your thoughts on that, Joe?
Well, very same to you. But another point would be that, you know, 100 years ago, the fishing season was quite short. And, you know, you had a long cold winter and spring sometimes wouldn't let up till like almost the end of April. So the fishing season was quite short. And we've had some years, 10, 12 years ago, where we would still have decent fishing till the end of June, maybe the first week of July. But that season right now, that window is closing, okay? And that's notable. But what we have different today than from 100 years ago is that this season is open all year now. And that's unfortunate, but the positive point of that would be that in September and October, when, you know, in cooler temperatures and a little, the rain, you know, fall rains come in, these rivers will fish well again, depending on how bad during the summer, you know, how hot the water was. But we do now, also notable, is on the Beaver Kill, we have a thermal refuge. Years ago, you know, we all commented and we wanted that. And you have basically July 1st through August 31st, you have a thermal refuge section where you have a couple of cool streams coming in and some deep pools, and the fish can you know, fare well for that time. You know, that's something that we have now that we didn't have then. So that's remarkable. Now, also note, without the tailwaters, we wouldn't have a fishery. We'd have a very limited fishery in the Catskills. And luckily, we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, almost, you know, major streams to fish that are tailwaters. So that's really the miracle of the Catskills in the modern times. Without those, we would be fairly in trouble. And as you know from studies, what's also interesting, and maybe a lot of your listeners will know, is that these fish travel within the system. You know, you can go way up to the, you know, the upper waters of the Willow. Fish can travel so far up from the lower Beaverkill. They can go up to the upper sections. They can go back down to where the Beaverkill meets the East Branch and then go up the East Branch. They can go all the way down to the main stem. TU did a telemetry study once, and they found this fish was just bouncing around all over the place. It would travel a lot within the river system. And I think that happens a lot. Late, early season, you'll find in lower Beaverkill, you'll find rainbows. And those are wild rainbows that come up from the Delaware, or actually the East Branch. That, and then, you know, when the weather, when the water starts to drop and warms up, they got to go somewhere. So they move out pretty quick. So, you know, there are a lot of factors. And essentially what, you know, we'll keep repeating climate change. Fish will be making adjustments as well, as we will have to make adjustments as well. So
absolutely. Very. Yeah, that's a brilliant point. You know, the fact that, you know, the brown trout is a master of adaptation to all kinds of niche environments, and so are the rainbows. So brook trout not as much. They require much more perfect biotic structure and water quality for them to exist, because that's the way they evolved. But the brown trout evolving in a structure where from lakes to oceans to rivers to a wide array and more tolerable of water temperatures. The Catskills is one giant migratory highway, as you mentioned, and these rivers are all connected. And the beauty for brown trout and rainbow trout to a rainbow trout, the rainbows of the Delaware that were introduced to Calicoon, they're basically beautiful steelhead. And when you see them, you catch them in the summertime, they have that silvery, beautiful reddish pink color through the sides. Their heads sometimes are a steel gray. They jump, fight like them. These fish have the ability to go up all these river systems. Even the Neversink is connected to the Delaware. So a fish could really, if he wants to go up the Hudson to the Esopus, you pretty much could go to any river you want if you're a fish. And the fact that people don't realize, but after fish spawn and winter water temperatures last for 2 or 3 months. So if you look at all these rivers, and it's something that Eric Richard did in Pennsylvania to get protection for brown trout in marginal trout water, marginal rivers that normally trout are not considered to be there. It's smallmouth bass water, pike water, but these fish migrate there in the wintertime when waters are conducive, temperatures are conducive, and plus there's a tremendous amount of biofertility in these waters. So a brown trout could go spawn in the upper part of the Beaverkill, go back down, go into to the East Branch, go down to the Delaware, could go all the way down to who knows where, Port Jervis, and could basically come back, eat down in Port Jervis a bunch of chubs and all kinds of warm water bait fish, and come back up when the mayflies start hatching on Bard Parker Pool. They're all migratory highways. So when you have one system that feeds another system, just enhances the bioenergetics, the fertility of each system. So you have a cold water dumping into a warm water dumping into a cold water. You have this constant exchange of high energy biomass. And when you have that, that's what makes the Catskills so unique. And I don't think the DEC really studied that as much as they possibly can, because it's costly to do that. But that's the beauty of those rivers. And you summed it up pretty well there, Mr. Ceballos. And on that note, we are going to take our first break, and we are talking Catskill Rivers. And when we come back, we are going to get into starting with the Beaverkill, the grand lady of the Catskills, and start working our way around. So stay tuned, listeners. We will be right back.
Able reels have been the pinnacle of reel technology for decades now. Since Steve Able, aerospace engineer, started the company in California, their technology and their manufacturing, the drag systems, are simply impeccable. They work to perfection, and everything they do is just a piece of art, including their art design on their reel systems. They're beautiful artists that they have in these series of all the different trout, salmon, steelhead, saltwater fish, utilizing technology with beauty and incorporating designs by Derek DeYoung, Larco, Underwood, other people are simply the state of the art. What's so cool is when you take a picture of a fish, like I often do with Atlantic salmon and brown trout, and hold my reels up against them, it's just beauty in the hand and beauty in the fish, and it just totally relates to the whole experience of why we fly fish and why we love what we're doing. So please look at Able Reels next time you're looking at a large arbor reel, and look at the difference and look at the quality, the workmanship. Another USA made company that gives each reel a hand touch, and their boutique made reels, especially the paintings. If you opt for the designs, which can be pricey, but if you're looking for that special gift for someone or you're trying to treat yourself, Able Reels are the way to go. Contact Jeff Patterson and Able, and you will never be disappointed in an Able product. Most of you think of Orvis as a trout rod and a reel company. I've known them for many decades, and I had my first Orvis rod, graphite rod, when I was a teenager, using up my hard-earned paper route money to buy one. They have been known so much for what they do in the trout world, and their stuff is outstanding, made in Vermont for since the days fly fishing really started in this country. And but they've gotten serious with their spay activity, and lately Combs and the rod designers got together and say, we're going to be taken seriously in this market, and they came up with the Orvis Mission two-handed series. I was blown away when I got my first Orvis two-hander, and I took it to Iceland, and I was just overwhelmed by how well it competed with the other rods that I had with me, the Sages, the G. Lewis's, the Berkheimers. They put in some serious technology in these rods. The beauty of them, the handles, the grips, the whole package is just simply amazing. And they are now a force to be reckoned with in the spay market, and you should definitely look at the Mission series next time you're going to purchase the rods. They're very affordable, and they're beautiful in the hand, and they feel just as good as the top line spay rod you could possibly imagine. So visit Orvis, go to your Orvis dealer, to your fly shop that carries Orvis, and ask for the Orvis Mission. Give it a test run and look at it, and you will be simply amazed how serious Orvis has come into this very competitive spay rod two-handed market.
Welcome back, listeners. We are with my professori friend, Joseph Ceballos, my Big Apple Braciszek, talking about the Catskill Rivers. And we are going to dive in right now to the grand lady. If you think of a Catskill River right off the bat, and it's almost like probably the most famous trout river in the United States, other than maybe the Yellowstone or some other rivers, but when you think about the Catskills, and you say to somebody on the street, hey, have you ever fished in the Catskills? And they say, yeah, I fished the Beaverkill once. Or they'll say, you mean the Beaverkill? Or they'll say, oh, yeah, Roscoe, New York, Trout Town, New York. So I think we're going to start with the beaver kill because it is the grand lady of the river that, you know, sort of synonymous with the word Catskills. You don't, you know, think of another river unless you say beaver kill Catskills. Catskills is beaver kill. You know, the river is made famous because it's Trout Town, USA. That's Roscoe. That's if you go downtown, it breeds trout. You know, what in the past, in this history of the Catskills, you know, the Esopus was probably the first river because it was up the Hudson where the trains from New York City came first. The Neversink was next with the Wurtsboro Pike and the thing. And even the Willowemic was a lot more accessible. But, you know, the beaver kill was fairly remote at the beginning. And it was a two-track, the Sun Trail, you know, the Esopus Indians hunted there. It was kind of a remote setting where, you know, the first settler, Stewart, and was sort of like, you know, it was a tiny town. It had a, you know, couple hundred, 200 inhabitants. It had tanneries, sawmill, a grist mill, two raucous hotels that you probably see in a Western or 1923 in Yellowstone. And so it was perfectly set up because, you know, once the train action started in 1872 with the Ontario and Western and the Ulster and Delaware railroads and gave access to the upper beaver kill, the boarding houses really didn't take place like they did as much as they were on the other river systems that we're going to talk about. But it's the grand lady. It still has indigenous brook trout in its upper sections. It's known for its brown trout, the historic pools, the legacies, on and on and on. The willow, the beemock, the two-headed brown trout, doesn't know which river to turn up. You know, P.T. Barnum, you know, paid $150 to bring back a wild brook trout to Hardy in the upper tail, in the upper sections of the beaver kill. So all that said, it is Trout Town. It's Trout Town, America. The Roscoe dynasty is there, the people there, the legacies, the Wolfs, Lee and his wonderful wife, Art Lee and a bunch of people. And there's just name upon name upon name upon name that is settled there. That's my introduction for the beaver kill. I could go on forever, but Joe, I want to hear your emotional introduction to this river and how it made such a big impact on you maybe in your early days.
Well, certainly. You talk about the beaver kill in such reverent terms. I mean, the beaver kill. The first time it was suggested to me to go to the beaver kill, to me that was big. That was something quite special. And I thought I wasn't up to the task. And I said to myself, oh, wow, beaver kill. Oh, boy. I don't know how we're going to do, you know, but after fishing the river for so many years, you come to realize that if the big man in his mind said, you know, I got to make a trout stream that is really special and have it in such a way that with your riffles, your pools, your long rip, like Karen's pool, you know, that flows. It's kind of a pool. It flows softly before, you know, you get some, you know, fast pocket water, whatever. The beaver kill is that stream. Okay. Now, from where we could fish it, what's very interesting is that there is one section on the upper beaver kill. And what I mean is in that section from the headwaters down to Roscoe, there are essentially two spots that you can fish. You have the Beaver Kill Campground. It's the covered bridge water. And you have a DEC put in there that you can fish. And that is, for the upper section, it's the only water you'll be able to fish. So within that first 20-something miles of basically, it's all private water. You have that one small section that you can fish. Now, below that, you have to go a ways down, another several miles to what we call the Rockland section. And the Rockland section there is one state access. And that, in essence, is considered the Little Beaver Kill, okay? Because when it meets a junction pool, the Willow, it becomes the Beaver Kill. And that section, you got about 15 miles down to where it meets the East Branch, is where you have all your famous pools. Upstream, you don't. There may be names for the pools, honestly, since it's private and you have almost no access. It becomes irrelevant. But what's relevant is the public water, and you have your junction pool, and all the consecutive names of the pools all the way down have each name of a pool has a history. You know, you talk about wagon tracks, Hendrickson Pool, you know, where did he get its name from? You know, Ferdinand's. Well, Ferdinand's were the, what was that? That was Walter Deddy's wife, Ferdinand. You know, that, you know, so you have all the barrel pool, you have all these consecutive pools that go down that offer all sorts of varied types of fishing. Right after, Junction Pool, you go down and you have your, you know, Karen's Pool, which is a long flat, usually gets hammered. And then it flows into Horsebrook Run, all pocket water. And then it goes into, you know, Hendrickson Pool, again, fast pocket water. And then below that, Horsebrook Run, there's all your fast water again. And you have all those names of the pools. So they call Horsebrook Run because of the brook that flows into the Beaver Kill, Horsebrook Run. I remember the first time I fished the Beaver Kill was at Hendrickson Pool. And that would probably have been 1988 or so. I caught a brookie. And I know that was very special. And I was shaking, and I put that fish back so quick. So you can go down. There's so many other pools that you can fish further down. Horton section, you have Horton Brook, and you have all these major brooks that come in. Cook's Falls, Cook's Brook comes in. Further down, Trout Brook comes in. So you have Russell Brook comes in. So you have all these little spring-fed streams that add water to the Beaver Kill and give it some cold water in late in season.
We're gonna try to touch on all these areas. You know what I think was really made the Beaver Kill was the boarding houses again, and it was the traveling customer. It was the city person that needed a place to go after Industrial Revolution was making the cities dirtier and crowded, and the boarding houses, the old grand resorts like the Riverview Inn. Deddy started selling their flies there out of coffee tins. Charles Ritz visited it. Ferdinand's daughter Winnie ran the lodge. Hey, Hendrickson, we're going to talk about the Hendrickson Hatch and Trout Valley Farm and up to Beaver Kill Village. You know, Gordon stayed there for weeks. You know, the trophy poles, the old days of coming back to these hotels and seeing 300 brook trout lined up on a pole with two gentlemen standing there posing, and that was it. And boarding houses had their little private little communities. They had the religious sects started coming in, sects, not the sex part. These people, this congregation, denomination didn't want to hang with this denomination, and this house was a Hasidic house, or that was a Presbyterian place, and that was a Christian, that was a Catholic place, and so the things started to happen, and that stuff was going on in the era of the Great Gatsby, you know, the spa wellness, come to the Catskills, and we're the first hotel that has a spa, and we have tennis courts, and we have, you know, what Kutchers, and all that stuff was going on in the early 1900s, and the Upper Beaver Kill, as you mentioned, is mainly private, but those private clubs started coming along there. And, by 1926, you know, the Browns started, infiltrating even the Upper Beaver Kill and displacing a lot of the brook trout territory. So Browns are home breaker. They're family wreckers, okay? So all you nativists out there that are saying I'm talking too much about brown trout, well, they are. They can dominate an environment. But what's really funny now is I'm seeing these clips from these nativist movements in Europe where they're eradicating brook trout from their waters because they're turning into tiger trout and eradicating rainbows. And, you know, so it's the same thing. But the bottom line is the brown started infiltrating, and Fred Shaver caught a 9-pound brown trout, 28 inches below Jones Falls on the upper Beaver Kill. And he said, just take one of them big flies late in the season and drag it on top of the water, was his quotes. Make it wave, and then boom, they hit it. So this brings back thoughts on Hewitt's Never Sink Skater and Bivisibles and things that just skate so well. As Ed Van Putt says, the brown trout dominated 60 to 70% of the water by 1953, and bookies were in their little tiny, you know, parts of these rivers. But once again, it's this Salmo truta that we talk about that has the ability to be that game changer, that migrator, that manifester that could utilize all the water. Let's go to 1965 no kill flies, groundbreaking regs, forged the fly fishing catch and release community. There were earlier brown trout. There were early catch and release waters. I think 1939. I think as early in Maryland on Big Hunting Creek and Beaver Creek. I think they were some of the first. But when you think of the Beaver Kill flies only water, you think of a religious movement that basically started. That if you were in Karen's Pool, you had to blend in with everybody in Karen's Pool, and you had to know everybody in Karen's Pool, and you had to follow a pecking order of Karen's Pool. And my God, if you didn't release a fish properly, and my God, if you did this, and my God. So in essence, what I think the Beaver Kill has done and has met is that it created a whole new era and style of fishermen. That you're a catch and release fisherman, and you fish catch and release waters. And you go to the Catskills, and you're the first one standing at the top of Karen's Pool, or you're standing at Barnhart's or Hendrickson's or Wagon Tracks or whatever. You made a Saturday ritual. A city man, a Big Apple man like yourself would take that drive, or somebody from the northern part of the state or somewhere else from northern Pennsylvania would come up. It created that person that became a religion. What's your thought on that whole flies only section?
Certainly changed the nature of fly fishing. Fly fishing only, catch and release. Absolutely. And subsequently, the no-kill zone, July 1st through August 31st, that changed things around a lot as well. You have sections that are open all year, essentially on the Beaver Kill, but you have sections that are closed and sections that are catch and release. So that that set, I think, the modern view or perspective on fly fishing, because then now you started with what? You go from Beaver Kill, now you go to the East Branch, now you go to the West Branch. It spread as that those things were introduced. So certainly it makes a big difference. That's my perspective.
Yeah, and let's talk about the Beaver Kill today in a sense. So a lot of people drive past it to go to the Delaware. I mean, it's common knowledge. Has the Beaver Kill become warmer? There's no question about that. Is there more runoff? Is there more siltation? But what's really interesting is Darby in the old days said, and you look at parts of, below Wagon Tracks down into Schoolhouse, Red Horse, Red Rose, Trestle, and down to Cook's Falls, and you're looking at these canyons. You're looking at these areas of the Beaver Kill and all the Catskill rivers, where you have underground springs coming into these systems and all these little tributaries on the Beaver Kill. When the water's good, the brown trout will go up there and spawn. That's why there is still natural reproduction in the main stem of the Beaver Kill. But a lot of these springs, like the brooks that you mentioned, going down through a series of all those pools. And Darby said, You got to go look for the green algae. You got to find out where that green algae is coming in. And if you find that green algae, you're going to find those springs, and that's where the trout are going to hold over, and that's where those trout are going to hang in those pools below that green algae. And, you know, me being a Spring Creek lover and loving Spring Creeks and a fanatical Spring Creek fisherman, I learned about that Greek algae, that green algae, when I was a kid in our farm in Poland. We had the Wieprza River was a giant spring creek, and you would fish in the summertime below those pools below that green algae because that cold water was coming in. So that green algae, as Darby is explaining, is watercress and duckwort. And when you see a big freestone stream, you don't think of spring creeks, but these are cold water effluents, and there's cold water effluents. And if you look closely at these little springs and you walk up them, you'll start to see watercress, and you'll start to see, you know, influence of a subterranean alkaline springs that are coming in from the bedrock, from the sedimentary limestone or regular sedimentary rock of the Appalachians. So that's something that we you know, Horton Brook, Spooner Brook, Russell Brook, Horse Brook, Cook's Falls Brook, these are all ice-cold water spawning tributaries. And you talked about now you could fish them year-round. My biggest fear is we're going to lose what little refuge and sanctuary water we have if we allow people to go fishing in them or even fishing at the mouths of them or all that. What's your take on that, Joe?
Well, there's a few other factors that come into play. Is that in addition to a lot of these brooks that flow into the Beaver Kill, you still have underground springs. And when you have development along the river, people drilling wells, and they're drawing water from the table, that's less water that, in a sense, could migrate into the river. And that can cause the river to warm as well. So that is something of concern. And as the river widens at times due to flooding. So in other words, it was at one time, let's say, 20 feet across, flooded, eroded. Now it's 40 feet across. So now that water, what X amount of water is divide by two, you know, so the water will warm up quicker. And that's something to be concerned about as the river ages, as we have floods and how the river changes, you know, and we have to learn as anglers to work with that. Okay. For example, there is a temperature gauge at Cook's Falls, and I highly recommend everyone to check the water temperature at Cook's Falls. Okay. And if, for example, at Cook's Falls, if the temperature gauge is 60 degrees, and you look at the flow, then you'll start, you can talk a little bit about flow and water temperatures and how water flows downstream and picks up temperature, right? You look at, oh, it's an 80-degree day, and you start out at 60 degrees at Cook's Falls. Maybe you want to go upstream a little bit and fish, or you go downstream and fish a bit, and then go work your way back upstream to the colder water. That's something that we should pay attention to when years ago, anglers didn't necessarily look at that water temperature as a factor. It comes up later that, you know, for example, George LeBranche says, oh, there was a hot day, the fish were sluggish. Oops, maybe the water temperature was up. And of course, the fish will be less active. So that's something that we need to pay attention to now. You know, we can learn about all the pools and start to address what flows works at what pool. For example, 700 CFS, maybe you don't want to be upstream so much. You want to be downstream a little bit where it's a little wider. If it's 300 CFS, maybe you want to go upstream and you want to pay attention to water temps. It's all part of what we have to learn now to be stewards of this resource. You know, we're all in it.
And yeah, we take the 70-degree pledge and you know, pay attention. We have the technology to do that. In the old days, LeBranche, Gordon, Hewitt, they didn't have that technology, and it was a bad day. Yeah, very, very good points. So, yeah, when you look at this, this is still a grand lady. It still has incredible water. But in essence, I think that we are going to see more fluctuations in this water. But I do hope that the three-year study that the New York DEC is doing that to test these year-round regs, I'm a person that believes wild things need a rest, and especially in an area where you're near the largest population in the world, you're trying to create wild trout fisheries and sustainable. And brown trout could resist a lot of junk. They could get a lot. They've survived Napoleon's cannons, Hitler's tanks. They've survived everything. But will they survive a constant onslaught of mankind is going to be the question for the Catskills. And that will be, could be that sixth mass extinction that they're talking about, is they survive so long, but how long can they survive with the constant beating that they're getting? Any other thoughts on the beaver kill?
Well, another thought would be that I believe FUDR has some etiquette protocols on its website, and per FUDR, they suggest higher temperature, like after 68 degrees, you should not fish. So, but in my perspective is, where is that 68 degree temperature? And you have very little time. For example, when is it 68? I have basically, it's my perspective is after 65. If you take the temperature on the bottom is 65, well, what's the depth of the water? And what is the, you know, if it's on absolute 65 on the bottom, well, what do you think it's going to be on top? And how, you know, what is it, 1 foot, 2 foot? What's the depth? So as you get higher up in the water column, you know, if it approaches 70, you know, and a fish comes up, you're going to stress the fish a lot more. Yep. And that's something that, nah. So those factors should be taken in when you fish the beaver kill, and a lot of it is rote. I encourage everyone to learn the names of the specific pools and some history behind them. And I think you'll be very rewarded to learn how, like, for example, I mentioned for Dan's pool or whatever, how these pools came to be named and the history behind them. I mean, we just don't have enough time to do that. And I encourage everyone to do their own research on those points.
Yeah, you know, Austin Francis's first book, The Catskill Rivers, is probably still the one of the most iconic. And if you really want to get in deep into that history, there's so many good tales about the beaver kill and all these rivers. So we are just being prophets of the word that has been written. So we're not inventing anything here. We're just trying to pay homage to the word and spread that word that was there. So please invest in these books. They're there. They're waiting for you. They're on Amazon. You get them in your fly shop. You get them anywhere. But they need to be read. And hopefully, if one thing that we're doing in this podcast is instill the love for those things and the love for the past and what the future holds and all the things. And that's where we're at. Let's go next to the beautiful willow, that beautiful Willowemoc. You know, here we had the home of George LaBranche, the icon of the Catskills, the master technician at the mouth of Mongop Creek. You know, here he penned, you know, the dry fly and fast water. Then you had the DeBruce Club, you know, owned by Ward, modern fly fishing resort, golf, tennis, fine local fare, farm-to-table food. They had servants. You know, when you went to fish the Willowemoc, you were, you know, you had a chance to stay at these places. And even LaBranche and Hewitt, as much as they love the Neversink and Gordon's Upper Neversink, Gordon and LaBranche and Hewitt had private property here. These were the cocktail and martini days. You know, there was a fly, the Pink Lady, a favorite dry fly pattern, pink silk, wood duck wings, ginger hackle, and then came the Pink Lady drink. Probably the first Hendrickson female pattern. So it was the good old days, the salad days, the Great Gatsby days, and the trains from New York City, Ontario, and Western, Middletown, Liberty, Monticello. They brought all these people in. And, you know, Horatio Smith was one of the first outfitters on the Willow Weemuck. And things started happening on the Willow. But I said, well, the Willow was probably more accessible at first because you had to come over the two-track to the Beaver Kill. So it did have more of this opulence that we had later in Kutcher's and the resorts. And now we have some Catskill resorts trying to renovate that old Catskill tradition. What are your impersonations and your first impressions of the Willow and your impressions today, Joe?
Well, the Willow, I think I have a very dear friend that I fish with. And his statement or what he feels is it's intimate. And what he means by that, some beaver kill pools like the Barrel way down, it's fairly wide, 40, 50, 60 something feet wide. All right. But the Willow, 15 feet, 20 feet wide, and further up you go, you know, it narrows down. So it's a smaller river. And it has that kind of feeling to it, which is different than what you would be on a larger river. And it's just a joy to be on to fish. For example, there's a lot more public water than one might think. It's interspersed. For example, as opposed to the Beaver Kill, where you have that pretty much that upper section is all private. You'll have on the Willow, the upper sections, as you mentioned, at the Bruce Club, and where comes the Mon Gap, that famous pool, Gordon fished there, LeBron's fished there. But going downstream from the Willow, you will find these little New York State signs, but you have a little access in there. And that's kind of interesting in that. And then finally, it comes to a lot of open water. And of course, all the little brooks and streams that come into it. So when you get down to, like, let's say, in the Livingston Manor area, it's a pretty sizable stream, yeah. You know, 25 feet. And then you flows down, you know, to the Hazel Brook or Hazel Bridge section, which is something that if you can't catch a fish anyplace else, I guarantee you'll get one at that Hazel Bridge spot. But that all that section, that's nice. That's really excellent water. And I believe if you go down furthermore, wasn't that Harry Darby's favorite pool on the Willow? There's a section yep. down there that is quite nice. Then yep. there's a short section before you come into the Junction Pool that it's a little bit private. But believe it or not, as we talked about New York State having access to water, there's quite amount of water access on the Willow and interspersed upper section, mid section, lower section. You can find spots to fish and, accessibility, you know, there's interspersed in that section. It's about 20 miles of river. So if one wants to hunt and find a spot to fish, you can. Remember in our last podcast, an individual was, I can't go up there anymore. I can't find water. You can find water, yeah. but you got to look for it.
Yeah, and you got to be hungry for that water. And, you know, I think what about the upper Willow is it's classic brook trout stream. From Fir Brook down, it's yeah. beautiful wet fly, soft tackle, swinging water that we forgot. And if you look back to, the Branches days and those days, that's what those guys did. It was amazing. I think that Ed Van Putt, he's the master of the Catskills, and he learned everything when he was with the DEC, and he explored it. He had the advantage of having the science and the fishing knowledge, and he loved to swing wets in brook trout water. He loved to put his Adams on and watch those brookies come out, because this upper section was perfect hemlock, spruce-lined banks. Lots of bogs and springs coming in that add to the fertility, which brookies like a little bit. Eventually the brown trout did colonize that upper reach, and they traveled all the way up Fir Brook area, which was one time just brook trout water. So, yes, they are the great invasive debate, but the beauty of it, that they could all survive together. And we here in Michigan have streams that wild browns and wild brookies get along very, very well, and the Catskills still embody that, in my opinion. Let's go back down to, you know, this diversity. You know, I think the one thing about the Willow, you know, it was the home of the Deddies, the Darbys, the Freestoners, the Catskills, these large pools, Hazel Road. You mentioned Hazel Road. I tell you what, I've gotten my butt kicked on the Hazel Road pool many times when these fish are taking minutia in August and they're on X amount of garbage of olives or this or that or trico spinners left over or crane fly midges. The Hazel pool can kick your butt because of the amount of fishing activity it gets. And it's a slow pool, and it's the slow pool eddies that transforms from one section of the wider open sections of the lower stem to the upper branches. And these pools are what makes a Catskill fisherman. I think a Catskill fisherman today could pretty much be any type of fisherman that he really wants to be. If you want to fish these upper waters, you can. If you want to pay attention to the sippers, and we're going to talk about those in techniques and all that stuff. But So my thoughts on the Willow and the Beaverkill is that, you know, they have their unique ambience. They have unique qualities to it. And you could go to the Catskill Fly Fishing Museum on the Willow and walk across the bridge, and you'll see trout in 2 feet of water sipping along the bank, and you could come there with your little tiny ants and get refusals left and right. And the beauty of the Catskills is the ability for the trout to adapt to pressure, but utilize all these rocks and crevices and these biotic structures. And they have the ability to escape in a heartbeat by just hiding under a big boulder and a rock. And that, to me, is the difference in the Catskills amongst all other rivers, because you have these giant sedimentary rocks on some of these pools that are as big as a house, to smaller boulders, to medium-sized boulders, to gravels. And they are all crevices for trout, brown trout, especially rainbow trout, even brook trout. So that's what makes them so unique. Any more closing thoughts on the Willow?
The upper Willow, I don't think the upper Willow suffered the logging that the Beaverkill had. I mean, that would be just given its size. You know, it would be hard to kind of get a raft or something on some of the narrow sections up there. So that water could be have a lot, that, from what I've seen, is a little more canopy. Another thought it would be is I recommend carry a thermometer with you, stream thermometer. Now you see the water's low, get the thermometer out and then see what's going on. The other point that you brought up, which was nice, is that swinging wets. Sometimes the water is so clear, it's deceptive, and you don't realize how deep it is, and that there are buckets. And by swinging wets, well, it can be very productive. So another point would be that when you are in the lower section of the Beaverkill, it's quite good. All right. It widens up a bit. There's a nice grade on it. And sometimes, you know, below Junction Pool, you could have a lot of water, too much water from the Beaverkill coming in. But the upper Willow will be fishable. Those are my thoughts.
We are back talking about the Willowemuck, and somehow we lost connection, and so bear with us, people. But we are doing final thoughts on the Willowemuck, and Professore Joe, I was going to ask you about your final thoughts on the Willowemuck before we go into the Neversink.
What I think I was saying is that in the upper sections, when the water drops a bit, I recommend anglers carry a thermometer with them to, you know, take the water temp and make sure that, you know, you're within limits. And also to dovetail back on what you were saying about swinging wets, sometimes the water is so clear, you really can't tell how deep it is at times. And there are buckets, and sometimes there's fish just a little bit of a divot or something, and there's a fish in there. So when you were mentioning something about swinging wet flies, absolutely appropriate and for the willow. And I think lastly, what I said was, and then you touched on about the museum, Catskill Fly Fishing Center Museum, that water is quite good to fish as well. And that water way further down too, there's another couple spots you could put in that is quite good to fish. So there's a lot of access there, and there's some deep pools in that section as well, which goes to the Hazel Road section. And then further down, if one wanted to walk, there's a lot of water to walk on there. There's a private section a bit further down, but there's still plenty of water that one could fish on the willow. And it like I said, you want to find a spot, there's always a spot you can find. So we'll leave it at that.
Yeah, another thing, you know, we have to take note, and this is really important that we discuss here, is when you look at these streams, they're boulder rock, gravel boulder rock streams, and you could walk this stream, and it could be less than knee deep. And if you're walking, we're going to talk more about this in the presentation and the tactics, but you could look at this water and say, oh, man, there's no fish there. I mean, you just look at it. It's shallow. If there were fish there, I'd be able to see them. And that's the first thing you always say when a novice comes to the Catskills and they see these really shallow spots of the Willowemic and shallow spots of the Beaverkill. And they go to the first New York State public fishing area and they look down and they see, oh, there can't be any fish. Their water's so low. I'd be able to see them. What, these fish blend in so well at the bottom. They blend in so well with the rocky structure. One part of them could be shielded by a basketball-sized rock. And the other part could be on the outside of the rock or the inside of the rock or the upside. The head is just poking out. You don't know where these fish are. And for so many people that I see come to the Catskills, and we'll talk, this is going into presentation, which I'm going to save, but you got to approach them that there's a trout laying of any size behind any rock in that system. And if you learn how to read the bubble lines and the current dynamics and where these fish are going to set up, and one thing, when you go to the willow, it's a lot of shallow water. And if you go to the public fishing areas, you got to remember that when Ed Van Putt and those guys and all the DEC people were driving around looking for public water, public fishing rights water, they were always trying to buy up the best water. That's the same in any state. They buy up the best water that gives the fishermen the best access to that water, to passability of catching a fish. The other thing is, Catskills of the Beaverkill, the Willowemic, they rely on stock trout. Parts of the Neversink rely on parts of the stock trout. The state comes in with trucks to those public access and drops trout off. That's what they do. They did it on my streams, the Wiscoy and the East Koi, growing up the Cattaraugus. You caught trout. If you saw public fishing New York State DEC, you have a good damn chance of catching a trout there at any time of the year, because that's where they stock them. And trout in the Catskills, brown trout especially, you stock them, 2 months later, they start acting like wild fish. They get finicky, they get fussy, they start eating natural food. A brown trout adapts really quickly to becoming, acting like a wild fish. So those are some of the things to think about when you pull into those Catskill signs where it says New York DEC fishing. Don't say, oh, geez, it can't be any fish here because everybody's parks here. There's always fish there, no matter where you go on any of these places. Okay, that's all we have for the Willowemic. We are going to take a very quick break here, and we're going to start up with the Neversink, the true hallowed waters of the Catskill legends. And we come back. Stay tuned. We are with historian and Catskill fly tire excellent, Mr. Professore Joseph Ceballos. And I am your host, Matt Sapinski, and we will be back in a second.
Books
and lines have been around since Cro-Magnon man and Neanderthal man, and that's what they caught to catch fish. And today, your hooks and your lines and your tippet material and your leaders are so important, and it's the ultimate challenge in what happens with you on a trout stream or a salmon and steelhead river. Hooks and lines are by far the most important things when it comes down to your choice of quality, and quality is probably the number one thing on the mind of English Sport Group from New York. Maxima leader material and leaders and Daiichi hooks are their specialties. And I've been a big fan of Maxima, as so many fly swingers and spey fishermen, for such a long period of time. Their chameleon match up to the toughest conditions, the abrasion. They're stiff enough to turn over large flies. The ultra green and clear are just perfectly blend into a lot of the blue-green aqua-looking waters of certain salmon rivers that usually have two different types of connotations, a tannic or a very, very bright, clear scenario. Maxima is the ultimate test pound for heavy, big flies on the swing. When that fish takes your fly, you're going to be very protected with Maxima. Daiichi hooks, there's not enough good things I could say about them. In the trout series, the specialty hooks that they have, down to their big Alec Jackson spey and their different type of spey hooks that they carry. I would always shop for the best. Shop for Daiichi and Maxima, and you will never go wrong. Hello, listeners. If you love the content that you're hearing on the Hollowed Water podcast series, Migratory Spey, you will love the books that were written by the guests that have been on this podcast series, especially from Topher Brown and myself, who did the inaugural four-hour series. We talked a lot about Atlantic salmon, and if you're addicted to Atlantic salmon, Topher wrote his book called Atlantic Salmon Magic, which was printed by Wild River Press, and my book, Brown Trout Atlantic Salmon Nexus, by Skyhorse Publications. Really take you to the next step if you like what you listen to, if you like all the content that we've been talking about in these podcasts. The next step is to go and read and get to dive deeper into what's behind the magic and the journey for these amazing fish. So we encourage you to go to Amazon, go to your local fly shop or to your bookseller, and request these books, which will make you see a lot more things that you've missed along the way, and dive further into the passion for Atlantic salmon.
Hello, listeners. This is Caleb, editor and producer of the Hallowed Waters Journal podcast. This episode and all of season 3 of the Hallowed Waters Journal podcast features music by Dutch EDM artist Arpo. You can find them on Instagram at Arpo Music and find their music on all major streaming platforms. Our thanks to Arpo for the use of their song Floating and for their support of the Hallowed Waters Journal.
We are back, Hallowed Waters podcast, talking part 2, the Catskill Rivers. And there's just so much to talk about. And given the amount of stuff we have to cover, it's probably going to be, Joe and I were, I guess Joe was just saying, we're probably going to end up with about a 6-part series here because we really want to be comprehensive. We want to give you all the meat and potatoes that we can for you to explore further on your own. But we just covered the Beaverkill, the Willowemic, you know, the two-storied rivers, Trouttown, USA, you know, a lot of the stuff that was going on in the old days and all the legendary names. But we're going to go to a river right now, to me, that truly embodies the hallowed waters of the Catskills. And it's a river that I began to know, and it is the iconic Neversink. And the Neversink is one of those rivers that 90% of the people drive by. and they go to the Catskills and they all run to Trout Town and Roscoe and places like that. But there's a lot of reasons why, and we're not going to get into all of it because Joe and I don't want to share our favorite secret spots anymore, you know? And this goal, the goal is not to let anything get out of the bed. The goal is to make you want to go out and explore these rivers. And one thing about the Neversink is that it is probably the most moodiest river out of all the Catskill rivers. It is a wicked lady. It could be very torturous. It could scorn you. It could do everything that you don't want of the ease of fishing Karen's pool or any other pool. You don't have a lot of luxuries on this river. And this river is a tale of three or four rivers all into one river. And it's a long river and it's got a lot of heritage to it. And, you know, it's the true diversity of the Catskills, the magic and passion that took hold in this river in the upper section, from that area up in those waters by Claryville is something very unique because, you know, Claryville, if we look at Trout Town USA as being the hub of the trout fishermen, of the great names of fishing, modern day names, Claryville back in the days of Gordon, where his residence on Aiden Brook and that area, that was like a religion. It was a cult of a community of trout fishing people that just worship the trout. And in these upper waters, you know, the Claryvillians or the Clarions, as Mac Francis said, they made trout their religion and could easily fish while they worshiped the fish. And it was so unique that, you know, even the kids in the school would have tests in school, in grade school, on how to tie knots and flies and how to read water and how to understand different sections of the river. Claryville was the trout school of life. I mean, these kids were all trout bums and they were all fishy little guys. And, you know, they could catch more than any city slicker would ever learn their whole lifetime. And that was that environment that Gordon and Steenrod and those people near Liberty and, you know, to have such a climate of worship of a river and the trout in that upper Claryville, Aiden Brook area. It's truly amazing to read about and discuss. And then of course the brown trout first introduction into the new world at Aiden Brook off the Neversink. So, you know, that whole thing happened. I got, the ability to explore this river and really fall in love with it when I met my beautiful wife, Lori. His parents had a summer home near Rockville and on the Neversink, near the Neversink. And, I went to go see it and I heard all about Gordon and Hewitt and all those great names. And, you know, you once you get there and you see that Neversink over the decades since the rise of the Catskill was always treated sort of like a bastard child. It had fluctuating flows. You know, it wasn't, you know, until the regulation of the flows back, I'm going to, you know, say it was probably 2008 that, or no, I think it was 2004 that the releases from Neversink reservoirs were capped at 115 as a base flow in the summertime. And so the stability of the tailwater was always in question. You know, it had public fishing areas. It was a stocked river, but then natural reproduction started taking over. So it had a lot of private water, had a lot of religious group camp and encampments there. It was always you were escaping to go to the Roscoe and to the Beaverkill and of course to now the Delaware. But these were Gordon Christian Hewitt's legacy on these waters. And you know, it was the bomb. And well, that's my first impressions, that whenever I go there, I walk into the shadows and the ghost of Gordon and Hewitt. What was your first impression of the Neversink, Joe, and how you see it?
Well, after fishing, primarily the first river was the Beaverkill. The fishing club that I mentioned, the Southern Catskill Anglers, I guess after a while I was, you know, a trusted member. And the guys got together one day and said, okay, we're going to go fish the Neversink. And I go, Neversink? What's that? Because when you're driving up north from New York City to Beaverkill, you drive past it. And it's kind of like what you said. So that on that particular day, we fished the Neversink, and immediately I fell in love with that river. And that was my river to fish. And the Beaverkill was kind of like, okay, that's good, but the Neversink's closer, so we'll fish it. But what we can say about the Neversink, think about what we talked about in the Beaverkill. You have the upper Beaverkill, what we call the little Beaverkill, and you have the Willow. Well, you have a very similar situation on the Neversink. You have the east and west branches of the Neversink, and they come together. And very similar in that you have all these private clubs on the upper water, and which is the coldest water at that time. There was no reservoir, so you know, you'll have close to the source where the water stays the coldest. You will have your trout anglers up there. So when you talk about Claryville, it's basically a little, I don't know, what is it, about a mile below the Forks, something like that. Mm-hmm. And you have that stretch of water where it's that upper stream pools. It has that intimacy of not being a huge river like the main stem of the Delaware, that you look at it, you go, I'm lost. I don't know what I'm going to do here. But you have a small stream that you fish. That simply is just, it's just truly gorgeous up there. And also the Neversink has the best water within the New York, the Catskill region section. You know, subsequently the reservoir was put in, and we talk about the flows were capped at 115. The city does not want to release that water, because even to this day, that water fluctuates in a pH between 6.9 and 7.1, 7 being the absolute ideal. And flowing downstream for many miles, that water is quite pure. And the Neversink actually contains quite a few freshwater mussels and fauna. There's some plants that are unique to the Neversink, which go further downstream below, what's his name? Oh, gee, Bridgeville. There's a section down there where it's almost like its own Eden, truly. Many years ago, PBS did a documentary on the Edens of the Earth, where they had these unique fauna and freshwater mussels and such, and the Neversink is truly is in that area. Unfortunately, the reservoir came in and chopped off about 8 miles of that upper section of water. The Neversink is quite long. It's one of the longer rivers, over 50 some miles, with a serious at least 30 some miles of good trout water. You can go way downstream, where Cuttybackville, the water, you know, these are people go on a map, they can research this, these sections way down. There's one last DEC put in where that water will still fairly in June, mid June. We'll still fish, and you're pretty far downstream from the cold water release. And from there down, the water is marginal, and of course, it will warm up more quickly. And the river eventually flows into the main stem Delaware. So, man, I would say in the late 80s, I used to fish on the lowest section of the Neversink, because it was open till November 30th. water was cold. And believe me, you were catching some serious fish, obviously, that came out of the main stem from Port Jervis. Now, Port Jervis, way below Calicoon. So that water warms up down there. So you did, you know, there are migratory fish, you know, in that section. And of course, we have all the other remarkable attributes where, you know, you have gradient, you know, the where the water.
Let's go back up to Slide Mountain. And, you know, we're going to talk about this whole thing. And I think we were just getting ahead of ourselves a little bit because I want to get back into that. But one thing I learned when I did an article for Fly Fisherman magazine back in 2008 called The Magnificent Neversink. And I put a ton of time into just reading so much about the Neversink and doing so much research and Mac Francis' books and everything and all the other books and Gordon's and LaBranche's. But one thing that really struck me was the true complexity of this river system that is even more so than any of the other Catskill rivers. And I learned a lot by that. And one thing I did after I wrote that article was I feared that the cat was going to get out of the bag on this river. And I said, oh my God. And I got so much crap from people like, why the hell did you write an article about the Neversink? And kept coming and coming. And so today we go to Fly Fisherman magazine. They write an article about the Farmington, or they write an article about this. They write an article about, and then they're like, why the hell did you do that? And the person that writes that article just gets blasphemed. And, you know, oh boy, he sold out. He told it all. But, you know, what's interesting is after I wrote that article, I probably wanted to kick myself and say, why the hell did I do that? But afterwards, I was afraid to go fishing there. I was so self-absorbed in my own little legend in my own mind that I thought, maybe, man, everybody's going to be on the Neversink now. And every place I wrote about it, I never saw anybody fishing it anymore. And I was like, why is that? And I think one of the main reasons is that river, let's start up at the top at Slide Mountain. That water is extremely cold. It's probably some of the coldest water in the Catskills, bar none. More than the upper Beaver Kill, upper Well, there's nothing colder. It's a narrow gradient. And that water is the color of teal, of like a bluish greenish clarity to it. That color remains into the entire Neversink pretty much the whole way down. And that cold, clear water, when it comes out of that reservoir, out of Neversink Reservoir, it is extremely clear. And you could go to the upper parts of the tailwater and walk around and can't believe how cold it is. But, you know, the history back then, we talked about the Parker Place. There was a guy named Clarence Roof, and he wrote in the Pine Centennial, The Trout Wars, about catching poachers. So it was always a battleground for city guys coming in, poaching fish, locals poaching fish from the lodges. Then you had the Big Bend Club of Hewitts and bought property from Christian. LaBranche fished with them. They kidded Hewitt of being a worm dunker because Hewitt was a Wall Street type guy that drove around with cars with holes in his roof to put rods. And so the legends up there were amazing. And, Gordon, the lowly consumptive person, you know, Hewitt was old money. It was a tale of a personality on top of personality on top of personality. And those upper branches were those homes. And today, they're pretty much private except for the YMCA water. They now get large runs of Lake Run Browns and Atlantic Salmon come up in the new seasons that are open. But that upper water has a low pH. So those fish, the wild brook trout up there, like skittering flies, like attractor-type flies. And we're going to talk more about attractor-type flies. But the complexity of this river is pretty impressive. Joe, have you fished any of that water up in the upper west and the upper east branch?
In the forks, you would say, the east and west before? Never. Never. It was pretty much private. I believe there is a YMCA camp or some sort YMCA of camp that met about 10 years ago, maybe more.
Frost Valley. Frost Valley has property. Yeah. You become a member.
Correct.
You pay.
Yeah, and I had I never really made it up there to fish. You still have brookies up there.
It's beautiful water. And they get some iconic catches in that Upper West and East Branch water. It has all the, it has your Quill Gordons, it has your March Browns, your Gray Drakes, and we're going to get more into the catches. But, you know, it's everything is overshadowed when the reservoirs were built. The reservoirs changed. They never sink. The reservoirs changed the West Branch and the East Branch of the Delaware. But, you know, these tailwaters were totally reformed these rivers. But what's really interesting about the clarity of this river and the coldness of this river is that you could go there in the summertime in the upper Neversink, just below the Neversink Reservoir, and you'll get some really cold water temps. And you'll have hatches that are normally they would be over with in other streams are just happening. So I think the great thing about the New York DEC, what they did with the Neversink is they bought up a lot of DEC property on that river. So except for the upper branches where you had the Big Bend Club, which is now under the reservoir. And now you have the Open Space Conservancy. They bought some water on the old Hewitt property. From Hasbrook down, from the Neversink Reservoir down, you basically have tons of water. And on any given day, you could drive up to these accesses and you won't see anybody fishing, not many people fishing. You'll get a few people in the springtime. The bottom line is these fish are not easy. They will spook on the worst cast. That you need long leaders, tiny flies. You to fish the Neversink. I'm never in fear of the Neversink ever getting overfished because the fact that these fish are so selective, and the wild trout fishery continues to grow. When other trout fisheries continue to lose wild trout, this river continues to gain, and it's the fluctuations in the amount of insects, and it's sort of a river that. Is a giant spring creek that you really have to pay your dues on, and the clarity of the water makes you have to really earn it. But going down from the reservoir, you know, you start at Hasbrook, you go down to Woodburn, through Fallsburg. This is classic water. Pools, rock, big, huge sedimentary rock pools, deep water. Water stays cold all summer. It's phenomenal fishing, and you just got to get back in there and explore. There's plenty of access for you to go in there and explore. And that access goes all the way down to the old Trestle Bridge, and along below South Fallsburg, and it's classic water, we can't give you too much information because we want you to explore that water, but there's plenty of public fishing. The catches are phenomenal. It has all the classic hatches. It has all the olives, and we're going to get into the hatches later. But all the way down to Bridgeville, you have the ability, except for some really posted water above Bridgeville along Edwards Road. And there's some public access in there, but you have to look for the old yellow DEC signs. And one thing that's really interesting is you'll see on this river and other Catskill rivers, you'll see a lot of posted property. And you'll look right along the road, posted, no trespassing. And this goes back to the old wars, the old trout wars that happened in the Sentinel back, he was hunting down poachers, and that's been going on for 100 years. But if you really go back and look and you see on the trees, you'll see the old yellow public fishing sign, DEC signs. And you'll realize, and if you go into the DEC website and look at their public fishing water, you'll see that this guy posted water that is New York State public fishing water. And you could challenge these people, whoever posted it, because if a game warden does come by and you're fishing next to a sign that says DEC public water, no matter if it said public, if it had posted fishing on it, you're still on private water. And if you stay in the river system, so that's a whole other issue we're going to tackle. But from Bridgeville down below the amusement park there, you have some beautiful iconic pools, and the water temperatures warm up. But the fertility of the river is really good. And then you have, what Joe, you were saying about the gorge, the unique area, the holdover of the wild browns and brookies down there by spring holes. So it does get hot in the summertime. So you have to pay attention to water temperatures. You can't fish Katrina Falls and drive down that road and expect to fish that in the summertime and go in there with a good conscience, because that A, it's one hell of a hike in, and B, those water temps could warm up. But the beauty of this system is the fact that there's so many ice cold springs coming in throughout the entire system that makes it, even when it gets into marginal trout water, it still has the ability to hold over fish. And the wild brown trout reproduction, I think, has doubled and tripled in the last 10 years. And it is because these fish are not easy to catch. And then you go down to Deer Park before it gets to Port Jervis, and they stock, 3,000. They stock most of the trout down in the lower system, but those fish will hold over. You go there in the fall, and you could have an ant hatch in the afternoon and see trout rising. So just because it has marginal trout temperature doesn't mean the trout die. They have refuges and holding areas where trout go. Any more thoughts on the Never Sink, Joe?
Well, for the upper river, again, due to the release, and, at times it fluctuates, 115 CFS, 130 CFS. So for the upper river, you probably will be below your knees. And sometimes, there's sections where it's just above your ankles, give about a foot. So as soon as you step in that water and you take two steps, those fish are gone. So when you talk about the problem of fishing the Never Sink, be careful. You want to stand and observe and look before you make a move, all right? Because the upper section of the river is like that. Also, you mentioned about it's cold. Well, that has an effect on hatches, which we're going to get into most likely number three or number four at this rate.
If we make it.
If we make it. But the river, if you think about it, has tremendous potential. And when the way I would suggest that is we look at, for example, the old days, and I'm giving away my age, we ate according to the seasons, right? You didn't have peaches in January, right? You ate according to the seasons, right? Well, you fish according to the season. You start low and you work your way up. You fish the lowest section of the river. The hatches, we'll talk more, but as an example, you start low and you work your way up. So there's the river, there's at least 30 miles of water that are interspersed with places to fish. Last year, I did a little, drive around, and I noticed that the one section, Cuttybackville, it's all private now. And years ago, that used to be open. So that's unfortunate. But then again, you have your point. I suggest, go to the New York State DEC website, look at where the access points are indicated, and start there. But there's tremendous amount of water there to fish. And, you bring your 7.5 foot rod, your 8 foot rod, your bamboo rod, and fish. Let me tell you, hallowed waters, just like you say, Matt.
Yeah, there's no question, Joe. And you made a very, very good point. The fact that you could go to these in the upper Never Sink of the tailwater, and you could go to these parking lots, and you'll see one on top of another, and you won't see cars there, and especially in the summertime. And through some of the early spring, the worm dunkers will come in, because there is no flies, only water there. So one of the biggest things that people think is, oh my God, if there's no flies, only water, then I'm not going to fish it, because I'm a flies only water and I'm a catch and release water, and that's all I do. And everybody, we're so possessed with this flies only. It can't have any fish in it if it's not a flies only water. Some of the worst things you ever want to do to a trout stream is put flies only water on it, because it congregates every, and his grandmother in that stream. And so, yes, it does get some worm dunkers that come down in the springtime, poach a lot of the big fish, not poach, they catch them. Big browns are very susceptible to garden hackle. I mean, when I was a kid, a night crawler and a big brown were the same thing. I mean, they were one connected at the hip. They do catch out fish when the water's high. But one thing about this river in particular, it is It is the most ultra selective spring creek you will ever want to fish in the upper sections. The water is so crystal clear, and the green vegetation on the bottom, and you could be walking in less than shin deep water and say, oh my God, there's nothing in this river. There is not a damn fish in this river. And you do that over and over again for years. Since I've been married to Lori for decades, three decades now, I've been going to spots and going there and saying, there's no fish in this damn spot. There can't be. There's nothing going on here. And then I would be there on one of those days where there was a big blueing olive hatch out of nowhere. Something happened. The gods made a revelation to me. The skies opened up. And I'm walking a piece of water that I would just call a piece of shit and say, there's not to be nothing here. And all of a sudden, I would see trout rising as far as the eye could see. And it's like the revelation that Marinero had on the big spring below McCullough's. He said, and then one day the winds died down in the summer in the afternoon, and then the dimples rise and thousands of fish as far as the eyes could see, hundreds of fish, whatever. Those revelations give you a concept of how a healthy stream with high quality water can have trout. And we give up on them because we think, oh, they can't be here because we didn't catch anything anytime we go. So it's all about self-absorption. Us, that's the new modern angler. More, bigger, fatter, better, faster, more now. I need it now. I need it now. I need to post it on Instagram, Facebook. I need to do something. And that's not the way the Catskills. The Catskills have learned to survive because of the ability for those brown trout to acclimate themselves to those waters and so finely tuned with the benthic invertebrates and invertebrates and everything that goes on and the different times of day. And this river embodies it. And as we get into the Delaware, we'll see more and more about that. So I think we've covered that topic pretty damn well. And then we're going to get into a whole other new big frontier in itself. The upper Delaware, okay? The Delaware system. I'm going to start off, you know, by just saying that, you know, this was a bass fishery. This was a warm water fishery prior to the reservoirs being built, prior to Papacton and Cannonsville Reservoir. But today, the Delaware system is probably the top three tailwaters in the world right now. You take the Bighorn, you take the San Juan, you take the Delaware, you take the Missouri, you take the White. They're all synonymous with some of the most perfect wild brown trout fisheries on the planet and wild rainbow trout fisheries also. But the sad thing about the Delaware, and we could do three podcasts just on the Delaware, but the sad thing about it is everyone wants a piece of this river. Everybody wants it. The fly anglers want it. New York City Water wants it. Kayakers want it. Naturalists want it. Private landowners want it. I mean, it's guides, outfitters. More people, more guides, more outfitters. It's probably the most love to death water on the planet, bar none, anywhere in the world. It's beauty. It's trophy wild brown trout angling and trophy rainbow trout angling is unparalleled. But so are its crowds. And it was bass water. Prior to the Erie Railroad, Ohio River bass were being imported there from Ohio with the Erie Railroad. They stocked Atlantic salmon in the Delaware back in the 1870s. They put 275,000 Atlantic salmon. One 23-pounder was caught in Trenton back then. Shad come in the river. Eels come in the river. And then the massive transformation came in the 50s through 1961, the massive transformation with the reservoirs, Papacton in 61, Cannonsville in 67, and everything changed forever. Went from a bass fishery, a warm water rock bass fishery, and now it's the fishery in the United States for the biggest population of people on the world. That's my introduction. Joe, give me yours.
What we have is a river system that truly rivals or equals many systems throughout the United States. And you have these reservoirs that feed this cold water down these streams, the East Branch and the West Branch. and ultimately into the main stem that really are fertile. And the fish counts are significantly higher, in my opinion. The West Branch, we could go to the Neversink and you'd be schooled day after day. There's fish there, but you, like I said earlier, if you don't bring A game and you really apply stealth tactics and such, you know, go, don't waste your time. But unlike the West Branch, if we start with the West Branch first, and basically you, there's above the west, the reservoir is a meandering small stream that goes on for many, 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 many miles. And basically, it would be just like your early season fishing, and then boom, maybe mid-June, water warms up, and that's it. There are trout up there. You can go from way above a deposit, way above where the reservoir begins, and go up almost to Oneonta, you know, 20, 30 miles, and you see this meandering stream. I've caught fish up there, trout. It's very small. It's very nice to fish. It's another option to consider. However, from the reservoir where the cold release starts, up in Stilesville, New York, down to the confluence where it meets the East Branch and forms what we call Bard Parker Pool, it's only 17 and a half miles. It's a relatively short section of water, of what we would say is a river that's fishable. And basically, due to the release, that can fish all season. And you have, when we get into hatches, you will find that it the lower section of the river, you'll have all that hatches. You know, maybe better not get into hatches. Let's hold something back.
But the river is
the West Branch is unlike what we talked about, the Freestone rivers. You know, you'll have, due to the release, you'll have a lot more, 250, you know, whatever the minimum flow that they give out. So it the upper section of the river is almost like chalk stream-like or meandering stream. You do have some, you have a nice grade and flow, and you do have some pocket water, but basically, no. Yeah, you don't, it's unlike, so you have underwater structure that you need to learn and figure out. So maybe and then the ability from these fish to move to the main stem and back again and move up and down. But the amount of fish in the West Branch is truly it's probably very much better than a lot of streams in the state.
Yeah, we're gonna get into the West Branch even more deep in depth, but I think we should start off on the East Branch and work our way that way. But you, right. If you basically covered what these branches are below these reservoirs, and they're almost kind of identical in a lot of respects. And you know, one thing, it was always the Beaverkill, the Willamimic. Now it's the D. Everybody goes to the D. It's that gradual procession of cars driving over the bridges to get to the spot. And how much can it take? And we're going to talk more in the future in the last section. But so, you know, this was the iconic home, you know, of Art Lee and Cauchy and Ed Van Putt and these guys. The Becks wrote an article about it. I mean, everybody wanted in on the Delaware when it happened. It was like the Bighorn. When the Bighorn happened and they opened up the reservation, everybody wanted in. But the Upper East Branch, you know, the waters above Papacton it's a classic upstate New York freestone stream. It's like a lot of like the Genesee, the Coshocton, a lot of those streams by Cornell. It's got ton of New York State water up there. I mean, there are tons of New York State public fishing water in this section. And, you know, you got the above Margaretville, you got Bushkill, you got the Batavia Kill creeks that are host of tributaries, Temper Kill, Platte Kill. They provide cold water refuges, brown trout spawning area. So despite these marginal temperatures, this upper water still has tremendous amount of freestone water. It's stocked quite heavily in that section, so the brown trout do hold over. It's classic fly slinging water, soft hackle wets, you know, night fishing with big wets in the old Jim Bashline style, you know, and it even gets big browns now out of Pepacton Reservoir, you know, when now you have these open seasons. So it's sort of everything. But Downsville, the covered bridge, and down below the portal is where these big browns cruise these flats. Have you spent much time fishing those flats at Downsville below the portal over there, Joe?
I take the Fifth Amendment. I've fished from Downsville all the way down to where the East Branch comes in to the main stem. Yeah. So, and that's roughly, it's the East Branch in that respect is about 37 miles, and that's all trout water.
Yeah.
Now, of course, the lower section where below the jaws, where the beaver kill comes in, that again is more like a freestone. So you'll, you know, maybe mid-June, maybe you're lucky if the last week of June, that doesn't fish so well. But from the jaws where the little, what we refer to as the Little East, from Downsville down to where it meets the beaver kill, that can be trout water more so. And again, depending on weather. But that water way up top is slow meandering pools. You have some riffle rock, very little, basically slow meandering pools. And what you have, though, that makes that unique is that time is that grade again, where the elevation and it drops. So you have flow, you have velocity. And that's what fish need. You know, that's what makes it so good. You don't just have it levels and it's a dead pool, you know, where the water barely crawls. And then towards the tail, there's a tail out, and where you have a drop and the water comes out. The East Branch from Downsville down, is fantastic water. And then again, what's remarkable is that the stream is, unlike the West Branch, is very wide. It could be 100 feet wide at some sections. The East Branch, 20 feet, 30 feet, maybe 40 feet wide. It's a much narrower stream. And given the release on the river, again, the same applies to the East Branch in that you could be knee deep and that's it. Occasionally, you might be waist deep, depending on the flows. So when you start walking around, guess what you're doing? Those ripples, those fish are gone. And people, yeah. And another fact that's quite remarkable about the East Branch, if those fish aren't rising, you're not going to be too successful catching them.
Yeah, you're not going to just pull up and neuronymph them too much.
You're not going to pick up and just start. Yeah, no. These fish, these, as I learned, you have your BA degree, which would be the West Branch. You have your MA degree, which would be the main stem. And then the PhD is the East Branch.
Oh, yeah.
In other words, truly, you have to bring your top game, and we'll talk about techniques
in presentation. But you wanted to plead the Fifth. You don't have to plead the Fifth because those fish will kick your ass on any day. I don't care
how they can. But
I don't think how good of a fly tire you are. They can and they will, unless there's some major hatch going on, or you catch the first dumbest fish and pad of fish in the springtime with the Hendrickson hatch on any given day on that East Branch. You will have to earn every single damn fish you catch on that river. And that's just the way it is. Anyways, going down, and you know, you mentioned that flat water, that's some of the thing that confuses a lot of people, how you fish it. But, you know, going down from Downsville down to Corbett, you have the Fireman's Park, you have Hog Hollow, Camp Campbell Brook, Corbett Pools, Harmony Farms, you know, Pepacton Cabins, Thayer Hollow, all that water is in that gradient system that you talked about, and that gradient system generates those pools, and it's one massive spring creek, and it could be really short environment spring creek, or it could be wide open flats that are 200 yards wide, 200 yards long, and almost 300 feet wide. And for you to go there and see this water and say, my God, this is sterile water. There's nothing. That a testament to the structure of the Catskill benthic environment, to those rock boulder crevices, that ideal brown trout water that they are looking for. And in that type of water, down to Chinopo, down to, you know, Peaceful Valley campground water, Trout Brook, you know, those are the long flats, that Tominex forest down there. It's big water. It's wide open water down to, you know, the mouth of the East Branch, down to, you know, Oxbow Campground. That's long flats. And you got to stand there for sometimes an hour. You got to stand there for half an hour till something goes, until something shows. Because if you're going to get in there and just do the Karen's pool, start flogging the water and walking in to the riffle, things ain't going to happen. So the East Branch is going to be wild brown trout water for as long as wild brown trout exists. And it's almost impossible to put a dent on those fish because of their extreme selectivity and the way they feed. Any other further thoughts on the East Branch, Joe?
Well, unlike out west, where you have, you know, per mile fish counts, huge, you know, the Missouri, the first mile in Missouri is what, 7,000, 8,000 fish per mile. What we have here on East Branch and then the West Branch are fewer fish, but we got a lot of food.
Yeah.
Okay. A lot of hatches. We still have a lot of hatches, which we'll get into. So they can be very selective. And another comment is, you can catch on. You can go to West Branch and catch fish. Okay. I'm convinced you. There are spots on the West Branch that you cast a fly. We won't get into. We'll get into it later. But you can hit the bank on that one section, and within 100 feet you'll catch a fish. The East Branch, it won't happen. It won't. No, you got to get lucky.
You got to get dialed in. You got to pay your dues.
You got to get dialed in and pay your dues.
You got to devote yourself to that stream. You got to devote your life to that stream, and you still will get your ass kicked. That's just the way it is. But
there's not as much access on the East Branch as in some of the other rivers we talked about. And the West Branch, you'll have considerably, you probably would have more access in that short 17-mile section of the West Branch than you would on the Little East. A lot of private water, a lot of private water. So you have limited, very limited access. Again, refer to your DEC and don't listen to, oh, yeah, you park your car and walk in here. No, no. Stick to the rules and you'll be fair. You'll be all right. All right.
There you go. Okay. Now we're going to traverse to the West Branch. As you say, you know, the Upper West Branch is another example of these upper Catskill rivers. There are probably 20, 30 New York DEC access points on the Upper West Branch from Stamford to Walton. It is loaded with New York DEC water. It is stocked with browns. These browns hold over very quickly. They hold over very well. By the end of the season, these stocked browns are acting like wild fish, but there's a lot of that public water up there. So if you want to investigate that, put your time in. The other thing about it, it gets the runs of the big browns that come out of the reservoir and upstream this year, there were some browns coming up there, and they've been always coming up if the season was close. But if you want to do some wet fly swinging, some spay rod swinging for fish and streamer fishing, you have that ability now. And, But be careful when you fish it. There's water spawning fish. You know, don't walk on gravel. Be respectful. Don't try to line fish. Don't try to do all the things, the bad things that we do in the Great Lakes here that I've been brought up to. But, you know, that section has a tremendous water. Now the new tailwater, the Bighorn, the East Cums, the grand West Branch from Stilesville down, the farm pool. When I did selectivity video back in 2010, the air temperature was 98 degrees. The water temp was 48, and there was a sulfur hatch coming off that was just absolutely insane. Tell us about what's the state of the Stilesville area today going down to deposit?
Given that it's very cold, you will have, when we get into the hatches, you have limited hatches. Given that it is fairly cold, and even through the end of July and August as well, one thing, it'll be heavily fished. You could have, as I say at times, a conga line of anglers from top, from as far up and down. So it'd be, you know, it can be frustrating, in that respect. But in terms of the hatch and the fishing, it's still quite good, remarkably good still. Last year, I caught some of the biggest fish I had ever caught up in the Catskills in that upper section. But again, you have to be willing to share, but that all of that. Oh, and there's, like you said, there's actually the upper section. You got a lot of access. Believe you are, accurate in that respect. It's when you get to Dreamcatcher, you have, there's a place called Barking Dog, which is a boat launch, and people walk in the Barking Dog, and then they can walk downstream. And you're on the east side of the river. The west side of the river, there are access points to the river as well. Some of them, you got to be a bit of a mountain climber and huck it down a bank or whatever, but it can happen, all right? And then when you get down to Dreamcatcher, probably midway in the river, now you start coming into private water. And then you got West Branch Angler is below that. It gets private. And then below that. So that probably halfway down. And just when you get past, Al Couchy's water, there are some open, there's some spots. So there's a midsection of that river that is still is quite private. But there's still, of that 17 miles, there's probably about half of that that's open to the public. And the river being quite wide, it is a very agreeable, because at times the fish are out in the middle of the river, so you can walk down the bank and you still have targets out in the middle. And at times, depending on the release, the fish are on the banks. So, we'll get into tactics later, but, it still is a great river to fish. Below the 191 bridge all the way down, you can fish to the junction at the main stem. You can walk up and fish. Once you're in the water, you have a right to fish. People put in, for example, if you were to stay at one of, Dreamcatcher or West Branch Angler, once you're in the water, you have miles of water you could walk if you wanted to. So you, in that respect, you could always get away from somebody.
Yeah, one thing about the West Branch is it's getting pounded with drift boats now, and the amount of guide services and the amount of guides coming in from all over. It's a bighorn. It's a Missouri and a bighorn. If you go to Montana, all the guides drive to the Missouri River. They'll drive 3 hours in the morning to get to the Missouri River. So that's what you have basically on the Delaware. What you learn about the Delaware is that the fish will eventually move to spots where they get less hammered. And some of my best fishing has been below the bridge in deposit, where people don't think you're going to find a fish downtown. So if you think like a trout, a brown trout, a smart, wily, conniving, cunning, wary brown trout, you'll probably catch fish, because these fish cannot take, they can take the pressure, but they prefer not to have it. And a lot of times you go to sections of the river, if you start at downtown deposit through the water treatment plant, flies only water, the upper flies only water, the braids below the bridge, 17 bridges, gets pounded. Any given day, you could go over that bridge and see 10 drift boats lined up in the first pool below the braids. I mean, it's amazing. And then you got your gentleman's club, and then you got Barking Dog and Route 17 pool and Dreamcatcher, and you keep going down and down and down. And You know, you got the game lands water. You got so much area that you could explore. Some of it you have to walk to. Some of it you got to get away from. Or, you know, sometimes the Hail Eddy Bridge, you know, and the Braids just above by the cemetery, by the church pool there. If you are willing to move around a little bit and just walk away and try to think, and we're going to talk about tactics anymore, but think like an outfitter does. So if you're just on your own waiting, think of where you want to be to avoid the flotilla that's taken out to go to the bar, to the bar in Pennsylvania, right across the bridge. You have to think ahead of everything, and you have to stay one step ahead. And, you know, Hail Eddy, I caught some amazing fish right in Hail Eddy, right by the bridge. I caught one with Johnny Miller, my bug doctor guide, in the evening, in the summertime, unusual, when there was a steno hatch. And, you know, this water that's right next to bridges can be caught. So you have to think outside the box and then think about where the fish are going to be, when the hatches are going to be. There's so much water. West Bench Angler, Monument Pool, Game Lands, etc. Couchies, like you said, Balzetti. Boy, it just keeps going down to Shehaken. And at this point, we are going to take a break, get into the Big D and wrap it up. And then we got lots more to cover. So stay tuned for the next part of this riveting episode with Joe Ceballos on the hatches and the rivers of the Catskills. Stay tuned.
I've known Marcos at Hairline for a long time, since he had his fly shop in Glen Allen in Chicago suburbs, the Fly In Field. Marcos was a serious, serious fly tying guru, and he had every material known to mankind imported from all over the place. Marcos has since gone to Hairline and has been there for decades now, and he's done such an amazing job of taking that company and taking it to the upper limit of having a one-stop place where you get the ultimate quality in hooks and materials and feathers and tinsels and designs and tubes. They pretty much have everything for the trout, the salmon, the steelhead fly fisher, the warm water fly fisher. But really, they've come into their own, especially in the Spey area, with the RX hooks, the Daiichi Alec Jackson hooks, all the intruder wires and materials by Greg Senyo, and importing some of the best products possible. You won't go wrong by going to Hairline and seeing the product offering they have. They really have pretty much everything. And even in the tube section, the HMH tubing and stuff like that, they have gone to the next level. So I highly encourage you to shop at Hairline. Tell Marcos I said hi. And it is truly one of the best all-around places to go for looking for that special material that you're in the market for. I can't say enough good things about G. Loomis rods. They're made out in Washington State for over 30 years, and their latest NRX series are absolute bombs. Steve Rajeff designed these Apex Beasts that are just amazing. Their new Nano Silica resin system is so amazing that it makes them so much lighter, and they can cast with so much more power throughout the whole rod. The lightness and the power generates are so much more important for the line speed, and especially if you're doing Scandi tapers, underhand casting with sinking heads, deep dredging skagits with heavier weighted intruders. They do it pretty much all. And even with floating lines, like in long belly, traditional spey casting, the stamina for these rods and the long anchors in this traditional style is amazing. They're very rich looking, and I highly recommend them, as does my friend Tom Larimer, their representative out on the West Coast. So ask for G. Loomis rods when you go to your fly shop, or visit them online at G. Loomis, but you won't be disappointed. Their whole technology is taking off, and it's just simply amazing. If you're a serious spey fisherman and a swinger, you're going to really enjoy these rods. Hello, listeners. As publisher of Hollowed Waters Journal, I'm really proud to bring you this magazine that we've put together, and we've been going really strong for the last year. Our accolade-winning and amazing in-depth issues full of sumptuous photography, fly patterns, and extensive tactical information can be purchased individually now in our archive series for you to read and reread over and over. We treat each topic and article as a mini Bible on the subject that you will explore with your passion and journey for trout, salmon, and steelhead fly fishing. And we'll hopefully rethink your relationship with these fish and make you fly addicted for life. No other magazine has the content and depth as Hallowed Waters Journal. Find out what you've been missing and come to hallowedwaters.com today and subscribe.
Welcome back. We are talking the Delaware River system, which is a monumental icon in today's tailwater, wild brown trout, and wild rainbow trout fishing in America that we just got done with the East Branch and the West Branch. And so much to cover, so much time. And this is part two of Catskill Trout Fishing Dynasty. And we are in the rivers. And it looks like we're going to be into part three and part four. Part three is probably going to be finishing up the miscellaneous Catskill rivers and get into all the super hatches. And part four will be in the tactics and presentation. So bear with us. We are trying to cover all this and hope you're enjoying it. And keep the letters and emails coming in from our subscribers. And we'll answer them on our last part. And we'll also, with the request of many people, to provide a complete glossary and compendium of all the books that we're talking about that will be very important for you to do your research so you could have use us as your books on tape and then get into the other books that are out there. So the main Delaware, the Big D, as it's called. My experience with the Big D was in the early 80s when I got to fish with a guy named Bruce Bartlett, and he worked for Jim Rusher out of the Salmon River shop, Whitaker Sporting Goods. And that's when Kochi Nostasi came floating by. It was in May afternoon. We were looking for Hendricksons and all the other stuff that we're going to talk about. And it was interesting because he had a big wooden drift boat and there was no hides or clackas or none of that stuff back then. It was a few of the old timers, you know, Pat, the owner of the inn, and Adrian was getting going, and a bunch of people. We'll talk about the guides and presentation, but the Big D was the big place to go. That was Bard Parker Pool, Junction Pool. Now they call Junction Pool, but it was Bard Parker Pool. It was a big, beautiful flat of a pool. The Big D is the fusion of the East Branch, the West Branch. It is the fusion of everything. It is heaven. It is God on earth. And some of the best days of your life will be had on the Big D. Some of the worst days of your life will be had on the Big D. And you really got to pay your dues on that river. I've had some great days talking with people at Bard Parker Pool. Junction Pool brings back so many memories with my buddy Paul Weimer, after I'd pick him up at work when he worked at the fly shop. And he worked at the Wild Rainbow fly shop, and then he worked at Border Waters, and we'd go and listen to Pink Floyd and all kinds of music and drink scotch and bourbon and wait for the Ice and Nickies to come off in the evening in the summertime on Bard Parker. And one night I ran into Art Lee, and I had some bottle of Macallan, and he spent some time talking to me about the Ice and Nickie hatch. And you know, it just, you could never know who you run into in those days and on those pools. And you know, it's just iconic water. And, you know, you start up there and you go through all the series of pools and stuff. But, you know, my experience with that river at that point in that time was it was a budding fishery. Kochi and Nostasi, which we're going to talk about in hatches, made it famous. But it was the mayfly paradise. It was the big water. And it was all about what the flows were going to be to get the right water. But it was nirvana when you hit it right. You hit it right. And what's your first impressions of the Big D, Joe?
Let me see. The first time I fished, floated, it would probably have been 1989. And I saw more anglers waiting than there were boats. Of course, it's reversed today, but the fishing was exceptional. Imagine what we perceive as Western fishing, but in Northeast United States. And the river is just, it is a river. As a, you know, when you look, if you say, oh, the Beaverkill River, well, it's like a stream. This is a river. I mean, I think it's what, 200 feet maybe at the widest, 150 to 100. It's extreme. You're not going to cast from one side of the bank to the other. So it's extremely, in my opinion, it's my most favorite spot to fish. Of all the places I've been, Montana, Idaho, Alaska, Washington, Oregon, wherever. The Big D is my place, you know, my nirvana. And sadly, we have only about 27 miles of river to fish with very little public access. That's the other issue. You have the upper section, you know, from Bard Parker down a bit you can fish. You got the Stockport section that you can fish. And then where else? You know, another spot. Let me see. There's one or two other spots downstream, but you probably have the least amount of public access of that 27 miles. But in terms of the river, you have basically flat flowing water, and then you'll have some braided water, chopped water, some water that has a lot of rocks in it that gives you under the rocks are typically given the flows are a little bit below the surface, but they give you these foam lines and they give you this structure that just make fishing so good. Deep pools that will hold fish. So even when, you know, the water temperatures are up, water flows a little bit down, fish have places to hide. And some of the best green drake hatches there. We'll get into that. But it's one great grand river to fish. And, you know, it's just my most favorite spot to fish.
Yeah, and it is probably the favorite spot of all the guides in the Catskills to fish. And it's the spot where you could find your own piece of heaven. And so it's you got to pay your dues on that river too. You can't just walk up to the Big D and kick ass. And first of all, you have to be a very good caster. And one thing we're going to talk about in presentation when we get in there is you just can't fish a little creek in Pennsylvania or a little creek in New York or a little creek in Montana or Colorado or Wisconsin and then go to the Delaware and expect to have command of the water. As the British said, one must have command of the water, and command of the water is proper casting. And if you got a fish feeding and if you can't throw a down and across reach cast and puddle mend that thing to let that leader, to let that fly drift for 30, 40 feet sometimes, these fish are extreme compound riser, complex risers, and they will study your fly. They will study every element of that hatching insect. And to pay your dues on the Delaware is you got to fish it a lot. And you got to be there. And a lot of it's luck and timing and to be in the right time when that hatch happens. And then you could have some of the best fishing of your life, or you could swear there's not a damn fish to be found in that river. And when I first started to learn that river, I was a Spring Creek guy in Pennsylvania. And when I was in Washington, D.C., and when I went to the Delaware and I wrote my first article, Big Limestone Trout. And I thought I was a big Joe Schmo, cool guy, big celebrity, you know, and I get on the Delaware and there's trout taking spinners about 70, 80 feet away from me. And my God says, throw that cast out, down and cross reach cast, you know, 20 foot leader and just wait. That fish is going to follow that nose up to that fly and follow it down. And I'm struggling to get 30, 40, 50 feet of line out. And on that river, plus the wind, it's wide open. That's a kick-ass river. It's like the Missouri. It's like a lot of the big wide open tailwaters. You got to have your game on. And the best way to have your game on is, number one, go to that place and fish it a lot, even if you don't catch a mountain of fish that you want. Number two, hire a really good guide that knows that water intimately. To establish a relationship with a good guide, a good outfitter, I could give you names right now, but we don't want to be partial to anybody. But this is not a commercial podcast. There's a lot of podcasts out there that are all driven by commercialism. We're not one of those. We're about the knowledge, the passion, the integrity. Get your homework, do your homework. But there are great guides on the Delaware, and they will show you that river intimately. And a lot of them are good friends of mine. And if you want to establish and learn a river, you have to pay your dues, but you have to pay homage to the knowledge that has established itself there. And that's one thing about this river. Whether you start up at Bard Park or work your down to First Heaven, Second Heaven, down to Piece of Shit Pool, which is now the Stockport Pool, which is the Big Bird Pool. Those flats, these fish are garbage feeders, man. They will go from one bug to another. You'll have a hodgepodge of 10, 12 bugs on any given day on that water. And unless you could stick with the fish, I talk about a garbage feeding rainbow I took on Stockport Pool in my selectivity book. And it was the most brutal summer long fish that I hunted, a 24 inch rainbow that kicked my butt on a daily basis. And it finally took a hot red orange size 22 ant when there were big isos coming down and big olives coming down. It shows you the tenacity, and those rainbows in that river are extremely selective. If you want to see some of the most selective rainbows on the planet, the Big Delaware is where you're going to find them. And they have the ability to cruise all the way down to Calicoon and back. Same with the browns. The hatches are amazing, which we'll get into. But that's pretty much all I could tell you about the Big D, other than you have to pay your dues on it. If you have a floatable, it does help you to cover more water, but you don't necessarily always have to have it. And especially on Bard Parker Pool, you could get into some great hatches when the water levels are at the right CFS. I used to like that 600-700 CFS was prime for me back in the days. The ISO hatches up there are phenomenal. That's my last take on the Delaware. Joe, your last take on the Delaware?
Well, what you have, given the size of the river, good and bad, and when I say good is, you have 120 feet. What, I've never measured it, but you know, it's more than a fly line across and then some. So it could be 150 feet across. So for someone who's wading, it can be forgiving in that a lot of times you have tremendous boat traffic. But by and large, about 95% are extremely respectful. That, in other words, if you're casting, whoever's rowing will go way out of their way to avoid you. And I've noticed that. Of course, there are a few nuisance, you know, people who row, I call them privateers. You know, a lot of times they're not guides and they'll just row right through you, you know, but that's something that you, for example, on the East Branch, if God forbid you see a boat pass you, you're done. On the West Branch, you know, you, depending where you are, it could be a little bit of a problem. But on a main stem, you got enough water that it can be forgiving. And when we talk more about it, we got to put out some teas, you know, about where fish are and how they lie and where to get them. So, you know, we're going to get into those details. But unfortunately, there's just not a lot of public water on the main stem. Now, I can relate one story below, and we'll talk about that, the Weir. Now, you can walk down from Stockport and that Weir pool. Now, it doesn't fish as well as it had, but one time, when you talk about the tenacity of a rainbow, I caught a rainbow once at the top of that pool. And I must have, I had to run with that fish. And what is interesting is that you equate them with like steelhead. And I had to run down the length of that pool. That fish was pulling line. I think it was on 6X. So I really didn't want to crank on drag. And I had to run as that fish ran. And I must have ran 100 yards to land that fish. And basically, it was about 20 inches. It was fairly large. I caught two more that day, and I decided that was it. I had three fish, which was, in my opinion, I had a great day. And I thought, you know what? It's time for that BAR and maybe a beer and take off. So those are my last comments in that respect. Again, pay attention to water temperatures and flows. You don't need to fall in and we'll find you, you know, way below, you know, Calicoon. It can be, it's deceptive. It's kind of flat. There's a few grade spots where the water flows and it just flows. Even in the so-called like flat sections, it flows at such a perfect flow, which is really great for fish. You know, there's one Lake Lenoir, one spot below Second Heaven where you're not even going to wade there. Very deep. And the water, you know, slows down. You want to kind of avoid that. If you're wading, you're not going to be able to wade in there.
Yeah.
Okay. But you know, keep that in mind. But anyway, it's fantastic.
Yeah, it's fantastic water. And, you know, there are great places to wade. You could, like Stockport Pool when the waters are low levels, you know, you could get by. Those fish move like crazy. You can wade for 100 yards.
You can, 2 miles, you could probably walk downstream.
Yeah. And you hook a big fish, he'll take you in your backing and you'll, you know, that's classic. I don't even know. You say classic tailwater fishing, but there's only a few places in the world that you could do that kind of fishing. And, you know, back then I used to, you know, walk the railroad tracks forever and ever to get down to Stockport Pool. And now people use a four-wheel ATVs to get down and, you know, drift boat or a floatable is the best way. Or some people kayak it and get to shore with it. But there's many ways to do it. The bottom line is there's so much water on this river. But if you want to get to know it, hire a really good guide. There's tons of them out there. And there's you be the experimenter with it. And trust, you know, you got to trust your fly shop. There's a great fly shop to Cross Currents. There's great fly shops in Roscoe, a Beaverkill Angler. There's all kinds of great fly shops, Catskill Flies. Everybody's a great guy. I mean, I got to remember, in Catskills, everybody's a great guy. He's a good guy. We're all good guys. Walk around, ask your friends, do your homework, pay your dues, be thankful, be appreciative. Don't expect too much. Expect to go out with a guide and ask him what he could teach you, what his knowledge is. A guide is a sensei. He's a Buddha. He's a psychologist. He is a master technician. He is your best buddy. You establish a relationship with that person. They're there and they're all over the place. And there's plenty of them. And there's new ones coming up. There's old ones going down. It's what you want out of it. It's what you want out of your fishing. And it should be about the total experience, which is what we're trying to bring you. So after that little brief, I don't know, was it mini sermon or whatever it was? But I'm losing my voice because it's 3 hours and we still haven't finished all the Catskill Rivers. So part three is coming up. This is part two. It's in the books. I'm going to shuffle the papers around like the news producers do. And we've gotten into only the big four rivers, which is the Beaverkill, Willamette, never sink in the Delaware system. Now we got to talk about the Schoharie. We got to talk about Art Flick's water. We got to talk about the Sopus, the water that Gordon used to love to fish and catch rainbows. You know, the water of Payne and his bamboo rods. We got so much to talk about. And then the other rivers. And then we got to get into hatches. And then we got to get into tactics. So hope you're enjoying it as much as we are. That is pretty much all I got, Joe. And we're going to start off with the Schoharie and go into that. And then the major hatches, which is going to be a whole other big deep delve in. But this is the Catskill trout fishing legacy dynasty that we are trying to crack. And we are hopefully going to do it, but it is taking a lot of time. So on that note, Joe, any parting words?
Do vigenia, my brother.
Dovizhenya, dasvidanya, auvidazhen, avoir, adios, amigos, and arrivederci, since I'm in the Italian mode, to part three of the Catskill Legacy. Be well, be good, do good things, and take care of each other and the fish and the planet, and it all come together. A goodbye.